Today at Reader's Corner, part two of our interview with Daniel James Brown, author of The Boys in the Boat, Nine Americans and Their Epic Quest for Gold at the 1936 Berlin Olympics.
Once they decided to do it, the Nazis transformed Berlin into almost a movie set. So it was a masterful piece of deception, basically. Rowing was the second most popular spectator sport at the Olympics in 1936. And that's why Hitler and Goebbels and Goering and all the top Nazis were there on a balcony watching this race. Pretty much all of Seattle was somewhere near a radio that day. And a huge roar went up in thousands of homes all across Seattle.
I'm Bob Kustra, president of Boise State University. Welcome to Reader's Corner. Today we're continuing our conversation with Daniel James Brown about his New York Times bestseller, The Boys in the Boat, Nine Americans and Their Epic Quest for Gold at the 1936 Berlin Olympics. The book recounts the amazing true story of a group of young Americans who, against all the odds, won a gold medal in the signature rowing event at the 1936 Olympic Games in Berlin. The Americans were from the University of Washington in Seattle. Competing against the favored teams from Germany and Italy, they pulled off a stunning upset in front of high-ranking Nazi officials, including Adolf Hitler. On last week's program, I talked with Dan about the sport of rowing, how these young men from humble backgrounds came together as an Olympic team and the challenges they faced along the way. Today we'll talk more about these so-called boys in the boat and their dramatic story. Daniel James Brown grew up in the San Francisco Bay Area and taught writing at San Jose State University and Stanford before becoming a technical writer and editor. He joins us from his home outside Seattle for this interview. Well, Dan, picking up from last week on your book, we were talking about Joe Rantz, who is the main subject of the book, but also about all the boys in the boat and what they faced in this incredible challenge, first of all, to become the Pac-12 champions and then to move into the Olympics. But let's talk about Joe Rantz for a minute. He had a nickname, a moniker that wasn't exactly the kind of moniker somebody in a rowing team wants, Mr. Individuality. And he had some issues that almost didn't get him in that final boat. Help us understand that.
Yeah, well, I think because Joe was abandoned by his parents during the Depression, as we talked about last week, and he had to make his own way in the world on a very fundamental level. I mean, having to forage in the woods, as I said, to find food to eat. He emerged from adolescence into adulthood, young adulthood, as a guy who felt that he couldn't trust anyone. He had to do things his own way and had a tendency to go against the grain. And that's exactly what you don't need in a crew. crew is a sport that requires, you know, absolute trust amongst everybody in the boat, absolute cooperation, very precise synchronization of the timing and psychological coming together. And so initially, although he was very strong, very talented with an oar, he had a hard time fitting in on that level. He wanted to do things his own way. He was good-willed and good-spirited. He was never nasty or mean about it, but the coaches had a terrible time getting him to sync up with the other guys in the boat. And so that Mr. Individuality was apt, and that's where that came from.
And I mentioned last week in our first interview the role that George Pocock played. And I guess among other things George did, like make the boats that they competed in, he also was a mentor of sorts and may have helped Joe get through this.
Yeah, George Pocock was this British-born builder of these beautiful Western red cedar shells that these guys rowed in. And he was a extraordinary craftsman. And both in rowing and in building his shells, Pocock believed in striving for the ideal, for as close to perfect as one could do. And he was also sort of a mentor or sage or almost spiritual guide for a lot of these kids, and Joe in particular. He taught them that rowing was about more than just winning. It was something that could elevate you. It could make you a better person. And this has a huge impact on not just Joe and that one crew, but actually on generations of of Cruz at the University of Washington. Pocock was a factor there for many decades. But as I say, it had a particular influence on Joe. And Joe eventually began to spend time with Pocock up in his shop where he built these shells in the University of Washington shell house, just sitting, listening to Pocock as Pocock talked about trust and about believing in himself and also believing in one another, and teaching Joe how to sort of let go of some of his negative feelings and begin to merge in with the other fellows. So it had just an enormous impact on Joe, and really was the point at which he began to stop being Mr. Individuality and began to put his whole heart into not just whether he won, but whether the whole crew won a particular race.
So obviously coaches are key to this business, and there was this incredible rivalry between the University of Washington and University of California, Berkeley. Describe the rivalry, first of all, and then the two coaches who really made that rivalry work so well.
Sure. Well, the rivalry went back to the founding of crew programs at both schools in the between 1903 and 1913. And it was, as Kai Ebright, the Cal coach, called it, bloody and ferocious rivalry. And there were some personal factors at work. Kai Ebright, who became the California coach, had been a coxswain at Washington and had hoped to become head coach at Washington. But instead, that job went to somebody else, and Ebright went down to California, where he basically revived the Cal crew program. And I think there may have been some hard feelings there about that. The Washington coach, Al Ulbrichtson, was a very interesting character. He was very reticent, very stern. They often called him the Dour Dane or the man with the stone face. He was a man of few words. He did not like to betray emotions. But because this rivalry between Washington and California sort of started off as a pretty nasty thing, it just got more and more intense as time went on. And for Washington, for Ulbrichtson, what it meant was that he watched Kai Ebright take California to the Olympics two times in 1928 and 1932 and win gold medals there both times. He watched Kai Ebright take California to national championships in Poughkeepsie several years in a row. And it began to really obsess Ulbrichtson. He wanted very much for Washington to be able to go to those Olympics in 1936. It was an extension of that rivalry, and it feeds a lot of the energy of the competition between those two crews in particularly 1935 and 1936. It was very personal for Ulbrichtson. And it's kind of fun to, in retrospect, look back at this sort of almost monomaniacal obsession he had with getting to Berlin, which he finally did.
Mm-hmm. And when Joe Rantz talks about, hey, if you're going to do the book, you have to do the book about the boat, Ulbrichtson knew he had an unusual team when that freshman crew beat Cal in 34. Isn't that right?
Yeah. That really was the beginning of what became the crew in 36, this almost perfect crew that went to Berlin. In 1934, as you say, the freshman boat from Washington went back to the national championships at Poughkeepsie and absolutely stunned the East Coast crews. It's not just that they won, it's that they rowed so beautifully and so perfectly that they just ran away with it. And at the end of the race, they were sitting bolt upright in their seats as if they could just keep on rowing right on down to New York City. That was the moment at which Ulbrichtson thought he had the nucleus of something that might, in fact, be able to beat California and go to Berlin in 36.
So what was the race that clinched the Olympic journey?
Well, you know, technically, it would be the trials in Princeton in 1936. That was when they actually won the right to go to Berlin. But in some ways, it was the race that happened just before that. It was the 1936 National Championship race in Poughkeepsie, which was a desperate affair and a very interesting race. Bob Mock, the Washington coxswain, held the boat four lengths behind the leaders, although he had been told to stay no more than two lengths behind. He held his boat four lengths behind until the last possible moment, and then he turned on all eight cylinders, and Washington just mowed down the field and won that national championship, beating California, which was their principal competition that year, and in the last 100 meters or so. And that, I think, was the moment at which Ulbrichsen knew and Kai Ebright knew. In fact, Kai Ebright said later that day that Washington was the crew that should go to Berlin. That was the moment at which I think they knew what was going to happen. They went on then and raced again in Princeton, where Washington beat California quite handily. I think at that point the Cal crew was pretty demoralized. So technically they won the right to go in Princeton a little later in June that year, but that Poughkeepsie race was the one that I think really made it happen.
I'm speaking today with Daniel James Brown. He is the author of The Boys in the Boat, Nine Americans and Their Epic Quest for Gold at the 1936 Berlin Olympics. And he, in spite of what a great job George Pocock was doing building these shells, I would assume that some improvements in technology has brought improved shells.
Absolutely. Yeah. The cedar shells are absolutely gorgeous to behold. The Husky Clipper, the boat in which the boys won in Berlin, hangs in the Washington Shell House now with spotlights on it. It hangs from the ceiling, and it's just a beautiful object. But yes, just about the time George Pocock finally retired from building boats in the late 70s, they began to build boats out of synthetic materials, first fiberglass and then carbon fiber. And those boats are certainly technically superior. They are lighter and they are stronger and they're easier to maintain. So they are capable of going faster because they're lighter. And the other thing that's happened, is as the boats have gotten lighter, crew men and crew women have gotten bigger. These kids in 1936, they were bean poles. They were tall, but they were skinny. If you look at pictures of them, you can see their ribs, partly because it was the Depression, and they were having a hard time keeping themselves fed. They were tall, skinny kids. If you look at rowers now, Olympic-caliber rowers, they are big guys all around. I mean, they tend to be very well-fed, very tall again, but much more filled out and developed. And so the boats, between the fact that the boats are much lighter now and the guys and the gals are much bigger, the boats go faster now.
So we're going to talk about Nazi Germany and the 1936 Olympics next. But before we get there, once these guys realized that they were going to the 1936 Olympics, all of a sudden they received this phone call that they had to raise the money to get there. This isn't like today when you just dip into the athletic fund. I know about that. Yeah. What did they do?
Yeah, there was no fund to dip into. Yeah, they were told actually about 2 hours after they won the right to go to Berlin, they were told while they were still in Princeton celebrating, they were told that, oh, by the way, they had to pay their own way to Berlin. Well, none of these kids had two nickels to rub together. There was no athletic fund at Washington for sending them anywhere except back to home. And Pennsylvania Athletic Club, which had come in second, stepped up and said, well, we have plenty of money. We'll go in their place. We came in second, which horrified the people from Washington, of course. So that very night, George Varnell of the Seattle Times and Royal Brougham of the Seattle Post-Intelligencer and other the crew coaches began to make calls back to Seattle from Princeton. And phones rang all over Seattle that night. And by morning, an organizing committee had been put together. And by that afternoon, there were hundreds of volunteers out on the streets of Seattle selling paper badges for 50 cents apiece to raise funds. And at the same time, large organizations were chipping in $50 or $100. The biggest contribution was the Seattle Times, I believe, chipped in $500. But mostly they were $50 or something of that magnitude, plus hundreds and hundreds or thousands of these 50-cent tag sales. At any rate, within 48 hours, they had raised $5,000. And by then, Al Ulbrichtsen had picked the team up and moved them to the Olympic training facility at Travers Island in New York because he wanted to make clear that they felt they were going to the Olympics. So they wired the money to Ulbrichtsen at Travers Island, and they were good to go. But they were good to go only because the citizenry of Seattle and the Puget Sound area in general just rose up and raised the money in very short order in a time when it was very, very difficult to raise money.
So it's 1936. Hitler is on his rise to power in Nazi Germany. They're going to host the Olympics in 1936. What was Hitler thinking? What was the world's perception of Hitler? And what happened next?
Yeah, well, of course, Hitler decided, although he originally opposed the idea of having the Olympics in Berlin, Joseph Goebbels, the propaganda minister, convinced him that this could be turned to their advantage. And so once they decided to do it, the Nazis transformed Berlin into almost a movie set. I mean, they cleaned the streets. They literally got down on their hands and knees and scrubbed the streets. They rounded up all the homeless people in Berlin and shipped them off to camps. They painted abandoned buildings and put pots of geraniums in the windowsills to make them look occupied. They just spiffed Berlin up extraordinarily. And then they put on this show, the Olympics. And the object, of course, was to portray Germany as a modern, enlightened, forward-looking nation, a nation to be admired. And the Berlin Olympics were done with such style, and there was such a show about it that hundreds of thousands of Americans who went to Berlin that summer and then came home, most of them came home with a positive impression of Berlin and the Nazi Party. They thought it looked like a clean, well-run, efficient place. So it was a masterful piece of deception, basically. And to a large extent, it worked, including, I have to say, for these young men who were on this crew and most of the other Olympic athletes. They didn't see what was happening behind the facade. They didn't see that Dachau was being constructed, you know, at the same summer that the Olympics were being put on. They couldn't, of course, see into the future what was about to happen to Germany's Jewish population. So as I say, they put on a very good show. It was intended to deceive, and by and large, it did deceive.
And Joseph Goebbels, who was the Nazi Ministry of Public Enlightenment and Propaganda, what a title that is, he even hired a filmmaker, Leni Riefenstahl.
Yes.
She played a pretty critical role in making this all look a lot different than what it really was.
Yes, and that's why I use the analogy of a film set, the transforming Berlin into a film set. Leni Riefenstahl was, of course, a remarkable woman. I mean, she for a woman in the 1930s to do what she did was amazing. And she was a very good artist, a film artist. But in fact, the film that she produced documenting the 36 Olympics, although she continued to the end of her very long life to insist that it was just a documentary, it was, in fact, a very masterful piece of propaganda. And she was commissioned by the Nazi Party. She was paid sort of surreptitiously by the Nazi Party to produce that film. And it's an odd film to watch now that we know what happened. It's very dark and ominous in many ways. But at the time, it had a huge impact. Even after the games were over and the film began to circulate in Europe and in the United States and around the world, it was part of this shaping of the world's opinion of what Germany was that played into Hitler's hands and bought Hitler time to rearm Germany and to prepare for what he knew was coming. So it was a very important part of the story, actually, what Leni Riefenstahl did.
There was a particularly poignant moment among the boys. I think it was Bobby Mack who discovers that he's Jewish.
Yeah.
At this moment they're going over there? Is that when it happened?
Yes, just before they were going to Berlin, Bobby Mock knew that he had some relatives in Europe, and he wrote home to Seattle asking his father to send their addresses because he'd wanted to visit them while he was in Europe. And he waited and he waited and waited, and finally a letter came from his father, and he opened it, and inside there was another envelope that said, "Open this in a private place." So Bob Mock went out in a field and sat under an apple tree and opened the letter. And in the letter, his father revealed to him for the first time that his ancestry was entirely Jewish, and Bob had never known this. And Bob actually began to cry as he was reading this letter, not because he was upset at discovering that he was Jewish, but he was horribly upset that his father had felt the necessity of keeping that from him all his life. You know, we forget that in the 1920s and 30s, there was still a lot of anti-Semitism here in the United States, and Mock's father had just not felt comfortable letting the world know that he was Jewish. So Bob Mock discovered that he was Jewish just as he was getting on a boat to Berlin, actually.
You're listening to a conversation about the boys in the boat, nine Americans and their epic quest for gold at the 1936 Berlin Olympics. We're discussing it with our author, Daniel James Brown. So you just mentioned that the boys really didn't get to see the real Germany. Is it fair to say that at least Bobby and his teammates, the coaches, understood, given what was going on in terms of at least discriminatory practices? Nobody was able to see Dachau and places like that, but the Jews were being rounded up. They were being treated differently. Shops and businesses shut down. Did the boys know enough about that, wow, this isn't the best time for an American Jew to be visiting Berlin?
Well, they certainly didn't understand the scope of it. I mean, there was certainly a general spreading unease that Hitler was a dictator, and you had to know something about what's happening to the Jewish population in terms of boycotting their stores and that sort of thing. But, you know, Kristallnacht had not yet happened. The Holocaust hadn't really begun to happen. So there was a general unease amongst them, but really, I have to say, there was no awareness of the depths of the evil that they were confronting. Within a couple of years, of course, that was very different. But I, to be perfectly honest, I have to say a lot of these guys came home, like a lot of other Americans, thinking Germany was a pretty cool place.
Yeah. Well, we talked last week about the victory. You mentioned some of the details of it, the American and the British team drawing the outside lanes. Any doubt at all that that was done on purpose?
I don't have any doubt. I did not find a smoking gun, you know, a single document that mm-hmm. said that the German Olympic Committee assigned the lanes the basis of preferring Germany and Italy over Britain and the U.S. But there's really no there's no logical explanation for it. The usual convention of assigning the best lanes to the fastest qualifiers, which were the U.S. and Great Britain, was completely turned on its head. They were punished and put in the outside lanes, and there was a huge difference between the outside lanes and the inside lanes on that windy day in Berlin, and it was windy every day. Everybody knew what those lane assignments meant. So there's no smoking gun. There's no one document that I could point to. So in the book, I simply reported this is what happened. They were assigned. Ulbrichsen was furious when he found out he'd been assigned the outside lane. And he went and he argued furiously with the Olympic official, who was, as I recall, a German Swiss. He argued furiously with him about it, but he did not prevail, and he had to race in the lane he was assigned. So, but yeah, you know, realistically, I don't think there's any doubt that the lane assignments were unfair.
So we talked last week about the fact that this will probably be a movie, and I'm already at the end of the movie, and the Americans have just won in spite of the way they've been treated, the lanes they've been given, and the camera is going to shift to the Germans. And as a filmgoer, I want to know what they look like and what they did upon losing this thing and realizing that their entire effort hadn't gone so well, at least in this case. Walk us through what we think we know about the aftermath of this.
Yeah, well, the setup was pretty cruel for the Germans in one sense. The Germans won gold medal in the first five rowing events that day, and so they were absolutely ecstatic going into this race. But the eight-man race was the prestige event of rowing. And rowing, by the way, was the second most popular spectator sport at the Olympics in 1936. So this eight-man race was a huge deal, and that's why Hitler and Goebbels and Goering and all the top Nazis were there on a balcony watching this race. As the boats crossed the line, there was only 0.6 seconds between the American boat's bow and the German boat's and the Italian boat's bows. And so nobody was quite sure at first who had won. And when the rowers, of course, at the end of a 2,000-meter sprint are bent over, they're sometimes vomiting, they're almost unconscious, the exertion is so great. So they're not sure what has happened. But finally, the loudspeaker comes on and in German announces that America has won. And up to that point, the crowd had been chanting Deutschland, 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 just thundering, this roaring thunder. It just fell silent as if somebody had turned a spigot off. And on the balcony, Hitler and Goebbels and Goering and the other top Nazis just wheeled around and disappeared into the building. And that's the last we see of them in the story. So it's kind of a fitting ending in that sense, as far as the movie goes.
And meanwhile, what was going on in Seattle?
Seattle was crazy. there was a huge run on radios. Radio was a pretty new technology then, but everybody in Seattle was trying to buy these new Philco radios that could bring in a signal from Berlin, although the races were also broadcast on them. I think it was NBC, National Network. So pretty much all of Seattle was somewhere near a radio that day, and in Joe's house, he and his father and his stepmother and his half-siblings were all assembled around a radio. And a huge roar went up, in thousands of homes all across Seattle when those boys crossed that line. This was the biggest thing in many ways that had ever happened to Seattle, certainly on a sports level. It literally was. Seattle had not really had any kind of sports celebrity before of any kind. And more than just on a sports level, Seattle in 1936 was still by much of the country considered to be, a logging town and a fishing town out somewhere in some mysterious foggy corner of the country that nobody knew much about. So in a lot of ways, what happened in Berlin that day started to put Seattle on the national map, and there was huge celebrating all across the city.
Well, Dan, I cannot thank you enough for taking the time to do this. For our listeners, I might want to remind them that this is a two-part interview. And if you go to BoiseStatePublicRadio.org, you can get to the first interview and then follow up with this one. Also, I might add, there's a wonderful epilogue to this book where Dan takes us through the lives and careers of each of these young men, and that to me was one of the more fascinating aspects of the book. We just can't say enough for your willingness to come onto the show, Dan, and for what a great book. Again, the title of the book, The Boys in the Boat, Nine Americans and Their Epic Quest for Gold at the 1936 Berlin Olympics by Daniel James Brown. Thanks so much, Dan.
Thanks a lot for having me.
Next week, Terry Williams, author of The Odyssey of KP2, An Orphan Seal, A Marine Biologist, and The Fight to Save a Species. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones, research by Kathleen Tuck. Our producer is Janelle Brown. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.